From the very first time settlers from Britain landed on the shores of the New World, there was a carefully laid plan for America, a belief, and an imperative one that almost unbelievably had its origins in the distant realms of prehistory. What was going on? We're going to have an interesting night tonight with two special guests. Our first guest, of course, is the co-author of the book, America, Nation of the Goddess. So stand by for that on Coast to Coast. And welcome back to Coast. We will have two guests for you this hour. They are co-authors of the book, America, Nation of the Goddess. Our first guest for the first 30 minutes is Janet Walter, researcher, writer from Minnesota. First-time author, by the way. She's married to the host of the History Channel's America's on Earth. You've seen that show, Scott Walter, who she travels frequently with to dig into historic mysteries. This is a first for you, Janet. Welcome to the program.
Yes, it is. Thank you very much. It's great to be here, George.
And how's Scott doing?
He's great. He's sound asleep right now, luckily for him. But
we're on the History Channel's Ancient Aliens show, so I've had a chance to see his work, and he does a great job.
Right. I've seen you on there. Yes.
And
really, really enjoyed making that show.
And whereabouts in Minnesota are you?
We're in a suburb of Minneapolis.
I used to live in Eden Prairie.
Oh, well, you'd be right across the road from me then.
I was there when they built the mall back in 1978. Loved it there. It was colder then, I think.
Oh, much colder. We've had a very strange, warm winter this year.
Yeah, it really is. So the next half hour, we're going to bring your co-author, Alan Butler, on. But let's chat a little bit about this and tell me about the mystery, because the subtitle of your book, The Venus Families and the Founding of the United States. What does that mean, the Venus Families?
Well, the Venus Families are a name that we gave a group of families that go back hundreds of generations that have secretly kept alive an ancient faith where the goddess was paramount, at least an equal with the male god.
Are they generally rich people? I mean, are they the elitists of the world or not?
Not necessarily. If you go back far enough, even hundreds to perhaps thousands of years, if you want to go back as far as the Egyptians, we're not quite sure how far back they go. But I think along the way, there were people who came along, especially in the 19th century, that were wealthy people that also became part of the Venus Families and worked with them.
And why do they call them the Venus Families?
Well, the planet Venus has always been a symbol of the goddess. And in fact, she's considered a consort of the sun in that sense. If you remember your astronomy lessons from high school, Venus was the planet that would rise a couple of hours before the sun
when it was
a morning star. But then the other half of its cycle, it's an evening star, and it follows the sun by a couple of hours. So this planet was considered the consort of the sun. And it also makes a perfect five-pointed star or a pentagram in the sky if you track its cycle. So those are all symbols of the goddess and became symbols of the goddess throughout history, which, of course, as we know, some of them were demonized by the Roman Catholic Church.
Okay, and tie this into these families, though. How does that tie in?
Well, the Venus Families kept this faith alive secretly, which is something, you know, going back in time, it was always about the goddess, Mother Earth bringing new life in the spring and so on and so forth. But then as the very patriarchal Romans took over the world, or took over Europe at least, that had to go underground because it wasn't tolerated.
When they all came here, Janet, did they have a plan for this land in terms of building a country?
I think they did. I think they've been very patient throughout history, and in fact, we believe they were part of the Cistercian order, which founded the Knights Templar, and eventually Freemasonry grew out of that. So we think what was probably going on is that they had probably made some attempts in Europe to try to take away from the crowns of Europe the feudalistic system and gain their freedom for the people, but that wasn't working, so they had to find a sanctuary. And we think they were coming over here as early as the 1300s.
What kind of influence did they have? Were they powerful people?
I think they were very powerful, and I think that they had ties throughout society. They weren't just necessarily people of one profession or one country. They had fingers throughout Europe. And I think they were actually part of, they probably had infiltrated the Catholic Church as well.
Were any of these people, Janet, in your opinion, or based on what you might have discovered, were they evil people at all? I mean, did they have evil intentions for this country?
No, I don't think so, not at all. I think their goal was freedom for all, freedom of thought, consciousness, religion, education for all. They wanted to bring the light to the people because that's how you fight tyranny. And I think that's what they believed in, and that's what they wanted to do over here.
What happened to their beliefs? Because we somehow have forgotten all about that.
Yes, you're right. We do have some problems with that nowadays, don't we? I don't know. That's a good question. I think they're still around. I know they're still around. And I hope that we as a society and as a human species can get things back under control. Because you're right, we do have some issues out there.
Oh, we sure do. I mean, we're going through a lot of it right now. I wonder, Janet, what would they say if they were living today, witnessing whatever we're going through? What do you think they'd say?
Well, let me take one example. I would say someone like Thomas Jefferson, who I think was part of the Venus family.
Okay. So people like that were part of that group.
Right, yes. I think that it would be shocking to him to see where things have gone, because their idealistic vision of democracy, as we've always been taught, for the people, by the people, has been skewed in different directions for different groups. And, you know, certainly we have people on the far right, we have people on the far left, and people all the way in between. But I think he would be surprised that we have had so many differences crop up along the way. Just like the American Civil War, I think that would have been a surprise to him too.
I think he would have been disappointed with all of that.
Yes.
And what's going
yes.
on today.
Yes.
Would he have been able to fix it? Would those people who came in to form this country, this incredible country, would they be able to fix what's going on now?
I don't know. That's a really good question. I think they would definitely strive to do so. They wanted this to succeed. I mean, you have to remember where they were coming from in European society. They were coming from feudalistic restrictions. Everybody was beneath some crown of Europe. You had no freedom. And freedom was the thing that we hear the most about when we're over here in this country and we're learning about our history. That was their main goal. So I think they would have been disappointed, and they would have definitely tried to do what they could to fix the problem.
They probably wouldn't be getting much sleep right about now, just watching and wondering what happened to this country. This is not what we intended when we came here or tried to put this together.
That's right. That's right. And I think they definitely had their idealistic ways that they wanted to bring to this country and to start this great experiment of democracy. But somewhere along the way, things have gone a bit askew. But the good thing is they did build some really great safeguards into the system. And, you know, hopefully they will, in the end, persevere.
I hope
so. We have the separation of church and state. We have the separation of powers.
Don't forget our Second Amendment.
Which is?
The right to bear arms.
Yes. That's right. But that was important probably to them back then, because that was something that they needed. I mean, they were.
We may need
that,
it too.
That was a way of life back then.
You
I don't know if everybody needs that today, but
you went clue hunting. You went to D.C., New York City, Grand Central Station. What were you looking for?
When we went to D.C., Alan had written a book actually before I started working with him on this project. He had been there working on a book called City of the Goddess. And he had been over there and noticed how many goddess statues there are all over Washington, D.C., and he started to wonder about that. And he worked with another co-author at that time, and they discovered that there was a very ancient measure that I'm sure he'll tell you about that goes back 5,000 years to Great Britain, where there's the ancient henges and Stonehenge, and it's called the Megalithic Yard today. I don't know what the people back then called it, but he found that this measure that hasn't been seen in thousands of years is actually all over Washington, D.C. Things are connected by this
intentionally
measure. Yes, intentionally. And so we began to look deeper into it. And as I got to know Alan, which we met him through Scott's show when Scott was filming with him, and he was astounded to learn the things that Scott and I had been working on, which go all the way back to the Kensington Rune Stone, which is a stone tablet that was found in 1898 here in Minnesota. And it has runiform writing on it. But through Scott's work, studying it as a geologist, he determined that this stone, which has been dismissed as a fraud, was actually genuine. That's what the geology told him, hard science. The weathering of the inscription was very, very old. So he began to dig into this more and has come to determine that, based on what's on the stone, that it was the Knights Templar who came all the way here into Minnesota following the waterways. And if you claim the headwaters of a river system, you claim all the land associated with it. So we think that they were doing that, claiming this land, and then that eventually led to what became the founding of the United States.
You think the Knights Templar came here with the Ark of the Covenant? Some people think they have it.
I think that's possible. I do think it's possible. I'm not sure if the Ark is here, but I do think that they at least brought information with them, scrolls, possibly relics, things of that nature. And I believe they learned from their mistakes in Europe, where they had problems running into, they were put down by the Pope, they were put down by the King of France, and they had to get their stuff out. It had to go somewhere. And I think it's a logical conclusion that some of it did make it over here. They did go to other countries as well where they were safe, such as Scotland and Portugal. So I don't think they would have put all their eggs in one basket.
It is amazing when you think of the metamorphosis, the growth of the United States since its inception from those founders who came here, how this country has grown to the incredible country that it truly is.
Yes.
I mean, it really is.
It really is amazing. And we also found in Washington, D.C., that they left some clues there that...
For us?
If you want to use the Venus families, they left clues there. And I think it was because they wanted generations further into the future to know that they were here and they were preserving some things that were very ancient, like this goddess faith. One of the things we found was that the Washington Monument, as it casts shadows on sunny days, that on certain days of the year, the shadow tip will just touch things that are significant on that date. And it started with Constitution Day, which is September 17th, which is also the time of the ancient mysteries of Demeter back in Greece in ancient times, which was the goddess, the Mother Earth goddess, associated with foliage and crops and things like that. So on September 17th, the tip of the shadow just touches the Capitol. And we thought, that's just coincidence.
This sounds like a Nicolas Cage movie, doesn't it?
Yeah, it would have been a good thing in that movie.
Secrets.
Yes. Yes. So we started looking at other things. Okay, what's the other most logical day to look at when it comes to dates in America? 4th of July, right?
Sure, you'd think so.
Yeah. So we said, does it do anything on the 4th of July of interest? Well, of course, the sun is much higher in the sky then, and the shadow is shorter. So we looked nearer the monument, and there's a very small, probably 2 feet by 2 feet by 2 feet square marker that's called the Jefferson Pier, P-I-E-R. And it's on what's called the Jefferson Meridian. When Thomas Jefferson was president, he wanted to have a United States Meridian. Well, it didn't ever actually happen. We stayed with the traditional meridian. But on the 4th of July, the tip of the shadow just touches Jefferson's pier. This pier sits on his meridian, which runs north-south through the White House and down through Jefferson's memorial.
There's a lot of symbolism there.
Yes.
And I think they dealt with a lot of symbolism. I mean, they were experts in mathematics and geometry, and they were playing around with messages, weren't they?
Yeah, I think they were. And if you think of an obelisk, which is what the shape of the Washington Monument is, going back to the Egyptians, that was a symbol of, you know, the phallic symbol, but yet it was also pulling down the deity, the male deity, the sun. So are they showing us that the shadow is the male deity reaching down to the sun, to the earth? Is that what's going on here? It also does another amazing thing, which is the thing that really wowed us, was on December 21st, which is the winter solstice, the tip of the shadow, which is, again, this is when the sun is now lowest in the sky, it actually can reach as far as the ellipse. Now, the ellipse, George, is that park that's south of the White House that's just a big open field, but it's in an elliptical shape. The tip of the shadow just penetrates the bottom edge of the ellipse on the winter solstice. Now, the reason we think that's so significant is because, first of all, December 21st is when the sun is at its lowest point in the sky.
Right.
And it essentially is dying. The sun dies and then is reborn and comes back in the spring for the rest of the year. So is this an allegorical fertility, a mating of the sun with Mother Earth? It's an egg shape, ellipse. Is it the womb of the great goddess? We think it's a pretty powerful representation of this ancient culture that worshipped this and venerated the great goddess and this relationship between Mother Earth and the sun.
Why cloak it in mystery and symbols? Why not just spell it right out for people? Why did they have to do that?
Well, because just like today, there were people who were more conservative and didn't want any of that pagan, you know, attitude left in this country. So I think it was just a practical thing. Hey, we can do this, and it's hidden right here in plain sight for anybody to see if they want to see it. We're not trying to hide it, but we're just not going to go out there and advertise it.
All right, Janet, we're going to have Alan Butler, the co-author of American Nation of the Goddess, join us next. Okay, welcome back to Coast to Coast. Now, our second guest is the co-author of America, Nation of the Goddess, Alan Butler, a writer, researcher from northern part of England in a professional career spanning at least 30 years. Alan has been responsible for more than 20 books, many of which deal with the subject of prehistory, which delve into the mysteries that kind of pepper the past of humanity. And here he is on Coast to Coast. Hello, Alan. Welcome.
Good morning, George. Nice to be with you.
You too, my friend. How have you been over these years?
I've been very good, and I've also been very lucky because I'm doing with my life what I like to do the most.
Well, that's great. You love these mysteries, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. I continue to be fascinated, and of course, they keep coming.
Yeah, they really do. In your career, Alan, what mystery have you uncovered, investigated, that truly was the most remarkable?
I think I have to say the realization that from the very earliest period of human history, there has been an underground thrust which has sought to make humanity better through freedom and democracy and the right to personal belief. And it's a very strange thing because you don't always see it appearing everywhere in history at the same time, but I've often called it the golden thread through the tapestry of time. It keeps reappearing, and of course, its most recent manifestation, and I say most recent in terms of the last 300 years, has been in the United States.
And what a United States it is. So many remarkable things going on here. Alan, have you ever heard the stories that it was conceivable that ancient Egyptians came here because they've noticed some hieroglyphs on, you know, canyon walls and things like that?
Oh, yes, absolutely, George. And one of the pieces of research which Janet and I are working on at the moment is to do with the Great Lakes area, where a great deal of copper was mined in remote antiquity. And it looks very likely as if a lot of that copper was brought to Western Europe, probably by a group of people known as the Minoans from Crete, who were contemporary with the Egyptians and had a lot to do with the Egyptian civilization. So it doesn't entirely surprise us. And I was known on the History Channel particularly for having coined the phrase, everybody and his dog went to America.
That could be. So over in the United Kingdom these days, what do they think about what's happening here with our presidential election, Alan?
Well, to be quite honest, George, I'm not sure that I could tell you on the air.
Thank you. Appreciate that. I understand where you're coming from. They've got to be just mortified.
Oh, they are. But I think that most of the people I know, most of the thinking people I know, I'm fairly sure that the Americans are basically very rational people and that everything will turn out fine in the end.
I think you might be right about that, Alan. And speaking about rational and investigating, what is it about this land that was so mysterious to these people, as you call them, the Venus families? What is it about this country?
I think what happened was that the group of people that I mentioned a bit earlier on, the Venus families, wished to create what they would have seen as being the ideal civilization, the ideal place for people to be. And they had been traveling back and forth to the United States for a very long period of time. They saw it as being the place where they could establish what they would probably have called the New Jerusalem, which really is just Venus family speak for the place where they can produce their ideal situation for people to live. So there was lots of things about North America that intrigued and fascinated them, not least of all the ability to be able to make something new.
And Alan, how many of them became Freemasons? Because we hear so much about that organization.
Yeah. Janet and I have come to the conclusion that Freemasonry represents the foot soldiers of the Venus family. So it's very important for anybody who's going to be associated with the Venus families and the changes they want to make to the world that these people have a certain understanding and a certain background. And it appears that Freemasonry was created in order to offer that possibility. So whilst Freemasonry itself is an institution in its own right, and incidentally one that's done many wonderful things over the years, even though it attracts a great deal of criticism, it is probably from Freemasonry that the Venus families get the people that they need to make the changes that they think are right.
What kinds of mysteries were these so-called Venus families keeping for so many years?
There is a certain knowledge that our most ancient belief patterns were a great deal more balanced than they are now. In other words, there was a god and there was also a goddess, and the goddess represented the earth. And the god, generally speaking, was thought to represent the sky, and especially the sun. And it would appear from our very ancient past here in the old world that neither one was more important than the other. But once paternalistic religion started to develop around about 2000 BC, the goddess part of the equation was pushed into the background. And it would appear that the main thrust of the Venus families was to balance up male and female as far as the godhead was concerned. And they did so via recreating ancient religions, which were called the mysteries, through things like Freemasonry and through other organizations, in order to perpetuate the idea that we need balance in order to create fairness.
The ancients, of course, did dabble with the Knights Templar. How influential were the Knights Templar here in the United States?
I told you a few minutes ago that the influence of the Venus families keeps resurfacing through history.
Yeah.
And there was one particular time in Western Europe in the 11th and 12th century when it really started to show itself, and when the Venus families gained control of a part of France called Champagne. They then started a multi-pronged effort to get things moving in the way they wanted them to move. That included creating a monastic organization known as the Cistercians, and out of that grew a military wing called the Knights Templar. Now, the Knights Templar were fighting in the Middle East, but more important than their position as soldiers, they were also tremendous travelers and great business people. And it seems absolutely self-evident that one of the first places they went to was North America. They had a lot of reasons for doing this, and particularly so by the time it got up to the 1300s, because by that time the Catholic Church had grown weary of the Knights Templar and decided to get rid of them altogether. The Templars knew that this was coming, and so one of the main reasons for having bases in places like North America was that they literally had somewhere to go when things really went wrong for them.
I would guess Christopher Columbus would have gone nuts had he known they beat him to the punch here.
Absolutely. Now, it has to be said that there's nothing very clear-cut about Christopher Columbus himself, all the motives for his journey, all the people that were backing him. I mean, it's interesting to note that even the pictures that appear in children's books of Christopher Columbus's ships show that they had a red cross on the sails, and that was a symbol of the Knights Templar. We know that Christopher Columbus' father-in-law was a member of an organization called the Knights of Christ, which in turn was an offshoot of the Templars. So he may have known more about this than we think.
I'm fascinated by the books and the movies of the Books of Secrets and special things that went on a long time ago, King Solomon's Mine and things like that. Is that real, in your opinion, Alan?
I think where we deal with, especially Solomon, is a good case in question. The historical King Solomon certainly seems to have existed. There may be significant overlays of myth that have been placed upon those stories, and often for very specific reasons. But I think our past is much richer than we believe. I mean, just as one example of this, we are now beginning to understand, and even archaeologists are beginning to accept, that our ancient ancestors got about a lot. They were expert travelers and tremendous sailors. So world travel was much more significant in the ancient past than we've given it credit for. But there's no doubt about it. People like King Solomon did exist. What their true effect on history was perhaps remains to be seen.
In everything you've investigated so far, have you come across anything like Stonehenge in the United Kingdom, any place else?
There are certainly structures in the United States. There is in New England a place which is called America's Stonehenge. I've not personally visited it yet, but in a month I hope to be there. And there are also structures called menhirs, which are balanced standing stones, and many other megalithic-type structures in North America. Unfortunately, most of these are ignored by orthodoxy because they just don't fit the previously prepared pattern. And if there's one thing that academics don't like, it's a deep mystery because they don't really know how to approach it. But it seems absolutely self-evident that that Stone Age peoples from Britain and from other parts of Europe had been to North America. And that would have been quite likely because the circumstances of the journey across the Atlantic were very different and remain very different from time to time. If we get a particularly good period in terms of weather, and this can last many hundreds of years, then it's possible to virtually island hop across the Atlantic using the northern route.
There is a word that you and Janet have come across in your book, American Nation of the Goddess, called the Grange. Can you explain that for me?
I can. The Grange was a word that cropped up in a casual conversation between Janet and myself when we were talking about a megalithic structure in Southern Ireland, which is called New Grange. And Janet said, Grange, I know something about that. And she came back to me a little bit later and said, yes, I realize now what it was. The Grange was an organization which was founded in the United States just after the American Civil War. And it was a sort of a club for small-time farmers to bring them together, to work together, and to put pressure on big business and upon the government, and to knit the country back together, because in those days, of course, the United States was predominantly a country of farmers. But it rang a bell with me because I mentioned a few minutes ago this group of monks called the Cistercians, who were so important in the Venus family history. Now, these guys were amazing, starting from one single abbey in Burgundy, in France. They expanded to become the most powerful monastic institution that the world had ever known. And they did so predominantly because they were great farmers. They were particularly good at rearing sheep, and the woolen industry, as it is in the world now, really owes a great deal to these monks. But the important thing is the way that they spread. They would make one abbey successful, then they would send out 12 monks and create another abbey, which would become a daughter abbey of the original abbey. And so that would go on, building sequentially, mother houses, daughter houses. But the whole thing was utterly democratic, in the sense that if a new abbey needed an abbot in charge, then that abbot would be chosen from the monks that were there by a democratic vote. Each abbey would send its own abbot once a year back to the original mother house in Citeaux, and there those abbots would elect the abbot of the whole order. Now, it just so happens that the Grange order in North America was and is run along very similar lines. Each individual Grange sends a representative to its state who is chosen by everyone else. And then the state sends a representative to the national Grange, which is in Washington, D.C. So not only the name Grange, which to the Cistercians represented the remote farms that allowed the whole organization to work, was critically important to both organizations, and also the way they were run was extremely similar. And this seemed really strange when you consider that they would be divided in time by, 700 years?
Yeah, absolutely. Alan?
Yes.
Now, with something called the Summer House, which is on the Capitol grounds, what do you think its purpose is?
The Summer House is a strange little building. It's not far from the Capitol. It was built in the 1800s. It was really meant just to be ostensibly a place where people could go and sit and relax. It's a very beautiful building, but unlike most of the architecture in central Washington, D.C., it's built of brick and not of stone. So it doesn't have the same sort of feeling of permanence about it. But we were to discover, thanks to Janet's intuition, that it's a very important structure because it turns out that it's a solar observatory. In other words, it's been built in such a way that if you stand in the entrance and look out towards the east, you will look to a statue, which is called the Peace Statue, which is what's known as an intermediate, a foresight. Because as you look past that statue, on the day of the winter solstice, which is December the 21st, you will see the sun set exactly behind that statue. This makes the structure into something very much akin to the kind of structure that was being built in the megalithic period in Britain, and in particular one specific structure in North Wales, which is called Bryn Ketley D, which is supposedly a burial mound, but which does exactly the same job as does the Summer House. Also, the Summer House is more complex. It doesn't just allow one to view the sun, but also to view the planet Venus and to use Venus as a means for establishing a unit of measurement called the megalithic yard, which was also possible in this other site at Bryn Ketley D. So the Summer House is, at one and the same time, a beautiful place to sit, to get a drink of water, to relax, but it's a solar and Venus sighting point.
All right, stick with us. We're going to come back in a moment, Alan, and take some phone calls with you about some of these mysteries all over the place. Alan's website, linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com, and very easy to find at nationofthegoddess.com. And don't forget, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and email me whenever you want at george@coasttocoastam.com. So those of you into history, get ready to make the call here on Coast to Coast AM.